It is Monday, October the 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, Syrian rebel counteroffensive in Aleppo.
The rebels and the jihadi groups, the opposition to the Bashar al-Assad government, and plus the jihadi groups, they were desperate in some ways.
Also ahead, impact of news media in the U.S. presidential campaign. There have been more earthquakes in Italy, plus the Pope heading to Sweden. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Syrian State TV reports Syrian insurgents have kept up their shelling of government-controlled areas of the city of Aleppo, killing numerous people, including children. Rebels have been pushing their way with car bombs and tanks into new territory in the western part of the city. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Ohio State University scholar Alam Payan if he's surprised the rebel insurgents have had the strength to carry out their counteroffensive in Aleppo.
They were preparing for this. I had information that they were preparing, but no one was really sure that when will they start this. So apparently they have somehow decided to go ahead and strike. So it was really a major offensive by the opposition, and some jihadi groups joined them too. The important thing is that they're saying that 38 or 40 civilians have been killed, including 14 or 15 children. And regime has lost about probably between 30 to 40 soldiers. It's a city now. Probably 252,000 people are living there. So they were under siege, and they could not get really water and food. So they were really in difficult condition. And the rebels had to start at some point, and they did. Now there's accusations of using chlorine by the opposition. People are not believing that. It's usually, I think the international observers have discovered and verified that the regime was using these chemical gases, not the opposition. So they are blaming each other, but this is the blame game is going on.
Well, this
the other way around. Yeah.
This rebel-held area has been virtually cut off, and there have been reports over the weeks that the government was engaging in what was called a final assault to take over the rebel-held sector, but apparently the rebels are rather tenacious fighters, and they're employing whatever tactics to repel the government offensive.
Yes, because the rebels and the jihadi groups, the opposition to the Bashar al-Assad government and plus the jihadi groups, they were desperate in some ways. That they thought that probably they are losing support from the other Arab neighbors and their support from the international community. The international community is not paying any attention. So they wanted to make this effort. So the regime, the people that who are supporting the regime, their argument is this is a desperate situation that they are doing. They wanted it's a suicidal, like you mentioned, that some of them were the suicidal attacks. But when you are fighting against a government which is supported by Russia and Iran, and really very little is left for the opposition, So they are using all these desperate situations. There is no question about that, with very heavy casualties.
Well, they still seem to be able to funnel fighters and weapons into the rebel-held sector.
Yeah, they do. The important thing is that it's the support of the 250,000 people. So the 250,000 people are fed up with the regime. So the strength of the opposition is that the majority of the Syrian population who are Sunnis, they do not like the regime. The heavy-handed regime with the help of Iran and with the help of Russia. So they can do these things because there is a popular support of these 250,000 people. No one can really be sure that how many, but the majority of them are supportive of the opposition to the government. So that's the strength. It's the same situation in many other countries. When the regime is very unpopular, people are mostly taking side of the rebel groups. This happened in Mosul too, because Mosul in Iraq was a Sunni majority city. the Shia-dominated government of Iraq and the Shia militias were suppressing these Sunnis. And finally, the Sunni population of Mosul welcomed the Islamic State. So the same sort of thing is happening in a smaller scale in Aleppo and other cities.
Alam Payan is the director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among the other stories we're following on VOA, Somali troops recapturing a village from Al-Shabaab, Serbian Prime Minister brushing off weapons discovery near his residence, plus the EU and Canada signing a long-delayed trade agreement. Expanded coverage of those stories, a lot more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. Also in the news, just a week away from this Tuesday, it will be Election Day here in the United States, and among the many elected positions up for grabs is the nation's presidency. The Democratic Party presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, leads in the polls ahead of the Republican Party nominee for President Donald Trump. She leads by just over 4%. Late last week, new emails possibly involving Clinton surfaced, and the FBI director, James Comey, sent a letter to lawmakers saying his agency had come across them in an investigation of former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner. Weiner is the estranged husband of Clinton's top assistant, Huma Abedin. Clinton has vowed that her campaign will not be affected as she has sought to push past the new FBI email inquiry.
So no matter what they throw at us in these last days, we're not going to back down. We're not going to get distracted. We're not going to get knocked off course because we know how much this election matters.
Meantime, Trump has called Clinton corrupt in regards to their email controversy, which surfaced in another investigation earlier this year and was eventually dismissed by the FBI. That's Donald Trump, the Republican nominee for president. In that case, Clinton had to answer questions about using a private computer system while she was Secretary of State. As you might imagine, the news media have been all abuzz about this. Both presidential candidates have taken issue at times with the way the media has reported on their respective campaigns. Trump has often talked about how much he does not trust the news media.
What I've seen is so bad. First of all, the media is so dishonest and so corrupt, and the pile-on is so amazing. The New York Times actually wrote an article about it that they don't even care. It's so dishonest, and they've poisoned the minds of the voters. But unfortunately for them, I think the voters are seeing through it.
For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Frank Sesno, director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Olivier Knox, the chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News, also host of the Yahoo program Top Line, joined in the conversation as well. Here's Carol Castiel.
Well, Frank Sesno, let me begin with you. First, let's talk about the media landscape here in the United States. It's very crowded, complicated. We have electronic media, network TV, cable TV, print, web publications, bloggers, social media. It's so different today than it used to be. There's mainstream media, there's more partisan media, obviously, so it's not a monolith, and we're not state-controlled like in China or Russia. But to the allegations of Donald Trump, is there any basis for his strident criticism of the media and its coverage of his campaign? How would you assess the media coverage overall?
Well, first let me say I think it's very important what you just pointed out to talk about how big and deep and varied the media landscape really is, because people talk about the media. There is no the media. And that's the first thing that I think we need to establish, because to suggest that there is a conspiracy, to suggest that there's something like a 7 a.m. conference call when everybody from the media gets on it to figure out how they're going to determine how they're going to trash one candidate or another on a given day, that just doesn't happen. It never has. But politicians of all stripes over all time always talk about the media being out to get them, because frankly, that's what a free media does to some extent. It holds the powerful to account. That is a cornerstone of our media. Few politicians like it. To your question as to whether there's anything to Donald Trump's criticism, I may surprise you and say, yes, there actually is something. He's wrong about dishonest. It's not dishonest media, not big and broad when we talk about the population. He's wrong about corrupt, the idea that there is some kind of corruption which suggests a systematic misuse of the levers of power doesn't happen. He's right about a pylon. There is a pylon, and we've seen it very clearly over the last several months, actually, but certainly reaching a new height after the tapes that you mentioned were released. The media, journalists in most news organizations, whether it's around that tape or around the other many factual inaccuracies that Donald Trump utters in debates and on stage in his speeches, have gone after him, as they should. But it certainly, to the candidate, will feel like a pylon.
Same question to you, Olivier Knox.
Let me just take brief issue with something you said in your introduction, which is the idea that Donald Trump has never been a fan of the media. He's its biggest fan. He loves the media. He hugs the media tight and doesn't let go. He likes the media so much that back in the 1980s, he would call up reporters pretending to be his own spokesman to dish the dirt on himself. His candidacy was created in part by this relentless media coverage, by the amount of attention that we gave Donald Trump. So the idea that he doesn't like the media, I think, is incorrect. He is, however, on the business end of the media right now. And what's important here is he's on the business end at a time when he's competing in the general election. In a primary election, you cited the $2 billion of free media. It's a lot more complicated than that. If you go back and you look at the coverage of his campaign announcement when he came down that escalator and declared Mexicans rapists and criminals, although he supposed that some might be decent people, for the next 2 weeks, that's all we talked about was the Mexicans are rapists comment. It turns out that media scrutiny of that nature doesn't necessarily hurt you in a Republican primary. And he lurched from what would be, for any other candidate in any other year, from crisis to crisis. He disparaged the military service of Arizona Senator John McCain. That brought on a whole wave of media, oh, is this, is he finished? But in fact, he wasn't finished. His campaign through the primaries fed on this media attention. It's obviously clear that now in the general election, it's hurting him with general election voters. He still has a sizable majority of Republican voters with him. But he's within the margin of error in a lot of these battleground state polls. But what he's losing is some of the pivotal groups in the general election. So the nature of the media coverage that he's getting, I don't think has changed a ton. But what's changed is the audience for his one-man show.
There's one other thing that's changed dramatically, and he changed it. And that is the way he has set the agenda of so much of the media coverage. So he gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he tweets something. And then CNN sees that, and at 5 o'clock in the morning, they're all over it and repeating it. And then another newsroom in some other part of the country sees it, or a talk radio show host sees it, and it's out there. And so we have never had a candidate who has been this successful doing this kind of retail agenda setting, presumably in his pajamas, during a sleepless night, which is kind of a horrifying thought. But there he is. And that, too, is media. That, too, is media.
Indeed. Well, I mean, as Olivier said, he got so much coverage during the primaries, free coverage, so to speak, general election. You have a little bit of a different audience. But either way, he seems to drive ratings, that is, at least for electronic media. So let's talk about that particular factor. The media outlets like that. He drives ratings, which drive profits. You know, so to what extent did the media help, in a sense, to create the phenomenon?
I think the political cycles, I wish I'd never said that award, would go to a man by the name of Les Moonves from CBS, who said, Donald Trump is terrible for America, but great for CBS News because of our ratings. That's what he was referring to. And that is true at my alma mater, where I worked for 21 years, CNN. CNN has seen that Donald Trump and talk of Donald Trump has delivered huge, in some cases, unprecedented numbers, which brings with it huge bumps in advertising revenues. So sadly, although tellingly, so it's sadly tinged with telling, Trump has driven these ratings. It indicates a degree of public interest, too. Question is, and the challenge for journalism and for media is, what do you do with that interest?
That's Frank Sesno of George Washington University and former CNN correspondent, along with Yahoo News Washington correspondent Olivier Knox. They were speaking with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to voanews.com and search under the Listen tab for Encounter. This is VOA.
Know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news At the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America, hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is promising to rebuild parts of central Italy damaged on Sunday by a 6.6 magnitude earthquake, Italy's most powerful in 36 years. No one was killed. There were some minor injuries reported. Historic buildings were destroyed. It was the latest in a series of quakes to hit central Italy. American scientist Harley Benz has been following these quakes for the U.S. Geological Survey. My colleague Lori London spoke with Benz and asked how damaging such a quake can be.
The rule of thumb is generally magnitude 6 or larger, and particularly in the built environment where people live, and particularly if they're shallow, we can expect damage. And you can also, in this area, the fact that it's been now been shaken by several magnitude 6s, many of these medieval structures are very weak, and so you don't actually have to have a magnitude 6 or larger earthquake to cause further damage. It's very vulnerable because of the number of weakened structures, also the age of the structures.
This is reportedly the largest quake in Italy since the 6.9 quake that struck southern Italy in 1980.
Yeah, and in fact, that earthquake was very similar to these. It was on the southern portion of the Apennine mountain belt. And so you have this beautiful mountain belt running up through the spine of Italy, and the geology is very similar the entire length of Italy along the Apennines. And so you can expect these relatively large earthquakes.
Is it pretty much a given now at this point with this large of a quake just occurring that there will be more aftershocks?
Yes. Typically these sequences can go on for weeks and months. Generally, the number of earthquakes will decrease in time, and the magnitude of the earthquakes will decrease. And so I can't tell you if this is going to lead to a bigger earthquake or not, but these magnitude sixes are typical for this area as being kind of the main shock. Now, is it unusual to have a series of magnitude sixes back-to-back like we've seen this? It's probably not atypical, but you have to keep in mind this is a very complicated area geologically. There are many faults involved here, or several faults involved, and so when you have one magnitude six, it can load another fault that may be ready to go, and so you can generate another large earthquake. It's pretty complicated. What you can say is they're all certainly related geologically.
That was Harley Benz of the U.S. Geological Survey speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Pope Francis goes to Sweden today to commemorate the Protestant Reformation, when Sweden became a grim place for Catholics, many being punished by deportation or even death. For some insight into the Pope's visit, my colleague Victor Beatty speaks with Father Brian Lucas, National Director of Catholic Missions in Australia, who talks about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, begun in large part by Martin Luther.
Sweden, of course, is a very strong Lutheran country, and there is an event where the Pope will visit the two cities of Lund and Malmo in southern Sweden to participate with other Protestant leaders in this commemoration of that very important historical event.
Well, that event was really rather anti-Catholic, wasn't it?
Well, it was certainly a fracture of Western Christianity. There's no doubt about that. And there would be many people who'd be very critical of any sort of Catholic participation. But like so many reforms and reformations, while there were elements in it, certainly, that were very contrary to Catholic faith and doctrine, Martin Luther made some good points. And the Church, of course, had to get involved in its own, what's called the Counter-Reformation, its own bringing the house to order, because the Church is a pilgrim church, so the Church is always on this journey towards perfection. But the emphasis of Pope Francis, and we've seen this now in the couple of years of his papacy, is about reconciliation. It's about trying to bring people together, what some people call, you know, the theology of encounter. there are differences in our world. There are differences that lead sometimes in the most extreme cases to violence. The antidote to that is to bring people together in dialogue and to show mutual respect. So I think that what Pope Francis wants to do in this encounter is two things. One is to join with the Protestant leadership in that event of encounter. But at the same time, it's also to strengthen this minuscule church in Sweden. See, Catholics in Sweden, there's about 110,000, 112,000 Catholics in Sweden, one point one percent of the population. So it's a minuscule church. And the Pope's presence and his willingness to celebrate Mass when he visits Malmö is an opportunity to encourage that church. These days, of course, largely made up of migrants, a lot of people from the Philippines working in Sweden and so on, form a small church that he wants to encourage.
The Swedish branch of the Lutheran Church is considered among the most liberal in the Christian faith. The top archbishop is a woman, and this faith has embraced homosexuality.
Well, that's certainly the case. It's on record that the female bishop is in a same-sex relationship. That's a matter that's commonly spoken about. Certainly, the church is liberal, and some would say is trying to accommodate itself to some of the thinking of a secular age. And this is one of the great challenges for any tradition within Christianity. How do you accommodate developments in secular society so that the church remains relevant, while at the same time being able to respectfully adhere to what are regarded as the core beliefs of the Christian gospel? Now, whether or not the church, the Lutheran church, in embracing homosexuality, same-sex relationships, has been faithful or not to the gospel is a matter, of course, of intense theological debate right around the world. I mean, this is a big international question. Whether or not the church, by liberalizing its attitude to some of these things, gains adherence, or some would argue loses adherence, is a matter, of course, of some analysis.
And as Father Brian Lucas, National Director, Catholic Missions in Australia, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And it's time now to see what's trending on social media. Our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, here. What you got, G?
Hi, Steve. Let's talk about the earthquake in Italy. As you know, the impact on the country's historical sites is simply devastating. An account called History of Italy tweeted, "The Cathedral of Santa Maria Argentina has been destroyed by today's earthquake." Hashtag PrayForItaly is trending, and the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Consular Affairs sent out multiple tweets urging Americans in Italy to notify their loved ones of their safety on social media.
You know, G, it's very good to see that social media is playing such a big role in connecting people in their times of trouble. Now, shifting gears, definitely shifting gears here, you got to tell me about this special pumpkin carving contest.
Absolutely. But there's a disclaimer. If you feel like an underachiever today, hearing about the competition at NASA is definitely going to make you feel worse. An engineer at the U.S. Space Agency shared several photos of the competition on Twitter, and his handle is @YazzySays if you want to check them out for yourself. And the spelling is YAZZIE says. He began with this tweet. "Goodness gracious people, the annual at NASA JPL pumpkin carving competition entries were incredible. Ready to see some? Hashtag NASA pumpkin." NASA JPL stands for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. There was a space telescope pumpkin, a Pac-Man pumpkin, and of course some election-themed pumpkins. One person tweeted, "I never should have shown my 4-year-old hashtag NASA pumpkin before we carved our own. Each request so far has involved a motor, dry ice, and fireworks."
Yep, very high expectations. You know, we have time for one more story. What might you have there?
This one also has to do with Halloween. It seems like at least one celebrity a year is in the hot seat for their Halloween costume. And this year, it's actress Hilary Duff and her new boyfriend Jason Walsh. They're trending because they dressed up as a Native American and pilgrim. Twitter users questioned their judgment and use of cultural appropriation, but some people defended the couple, saying that, you know, it's all lighthearted, let's take it easy. That's all for me today. Steve?
Yeah, absolutely, G. You know, I got to say, that's why I always dress up as myself, blue jeans and a polo shirt. Hey, what else did you wear, huh? VOA's G. Abby Lee, good to have you with us. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. Our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The final bits of data gathered by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft during its July 2015 flyby of Pluto were received this week by its Mission Operations Center at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland. More than 50 gigabytes of observational data was stored on the spacecraft's digital recorders since the flyby. The data has been sent back to Earth in increments over a 15-month period. Mission officials say part of an observation sequence of Pluto and its largest moon, Charon, were included in the final data feed. Traveling at light speed, the data made the nearly 50 billion kilometer trip in about 5 hours. After conducting a final verification of all received data, mission team members will clear space on the spacecraft's digital recorders to make room for new data that will be gathered in its upcoming exploration of the Kuiper Belt. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. You know, a creepy clown craze has taken America by storm in recent months, triggered by phantom clown sightings just about everywhere. Similar sightings happened back in the mid-1980s, also in the early 90s. Then, since then, no one has really capitalized on the fear of the clown face any more than the movie industry, as we hear now from Penelope Pulu.
Who can forget the original Poltergeist? Directed by Tobe Hooper and written by Steven Spielberg, the 1982 horror flick became a classic for its unprecedented storyline and chilling atmosphere in a quaint suburb where restless ghosts haunt the house of a middle-class family and kidnap one of the children. In one of the most unnerving scenes, a creepy toy clown comes to life. The scary clown is embodied by Batman's arch-nemesis, the Joker, who wreaks havoc in Gotham City. The first time the character appeared on TV was about 50 years ago, but Jack Nicholson's portrayal of the Joker was more menacing in the 1989 film as he taunted Batman and planned to poison thousands of civilians. The same role was reprised even more memorably by the late Heath Ledger in Chris Nolan's 2008 The Dark Knight.
Hi.
Nolan and Ledger go a step further in depicting the evil clown. The Joker no longer hides behind the jovial clown mask or heavy makeup. His face is mutilated into a contorted clown grimace. That vision has inspired other more twisted interpretations of evil clowns. One of them is the 2016 horror film Clown. To entertain his son's birthday party, a father dons a clown suit he finds in his attic, only to discover he cannot take it off. The dad loses his mind and turns murderous as the suit starts growing into his skin.
Two.
The recently released Tyler Perry's Boo, a Madea Halloween, incorporates the scary clown theme but infuses it with humor by portraying the mishaps of Madea, a big busty woman, as she faces up to ghouls and clowns while keeping a watchful eye on teens during Halloween. So whether it is the supernatural mask of evil or a mere mortal with evil intentions, the creepy clown persona taps into our fears of the unnatural, which has us screaming in fear and coming back for more.
What are you doing down there, Daddy?
Come downstairs. I want to see my number one birthday boy.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Crazy, seriously horrible movies, huh? Would you go see any of those? Of course you would. People love horror movies. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday, everyone.